I hope everyone is getting an opportunity to enjoy a peaceful and restful holiday. Also, thank you everyone for listening and sharing this podcast with others. As we are preparing for season 2 episodes, we love to hear from you as we value your input and appreciate your continued support. You can send us an email, a message on LinkedIn, or send a voice message. You can also support the People of Color in Psychology podcast through registering for continuing education programs on the Multicultural Counseling Institute's website or making a donation of any amount. We have a live CE webinar on January 26th taught by Dr. Myrna Mejia on cognitive behavioral therapy for chronic pain with Hispanic clients. Hope to see y'all at the webinar. Now onward to today's episode. Remember the carefree days of college? Yeah, about that. Today's campuses are pressure cookers of anxiety and social disconnect, which the pandemic just cranked up the heat. The fact is, mental health care in college and university counseling centers, they are an evolving landscape as the needs of student populations are also changing. So what are mental health providers seeing in terms of the issues that students are coming for help with compared to a decade ago? What are the set of skills that are now needed for mental health providers working in college and university counseling centers? And are the institutions willing to also change with the needs of the student population? What are some innovative care models needed to reach every student in need, especially students of color? Welcome to People of Color in Psychology, the show that explores mental health topics specific to culture, diversity, and communities of color. I am your host, Jack Tsen. Our guest today is Dr. Rekha Burgess, a Singaporean Indian licensed clinical psychologist in Washington, D.C. and Michigan, as well as a PsychPact provider. She is currently the Director of Counseling and Psychological Services at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. In previous institutions, she has served as a Director of Outreach, as well as a Director of Training for pre-licensure psychologists and social workers. This is her 9th year on staff at a university college counseling center, and she has also worked in community mental health and a K-8 school. She works from a psychodynamic and relational cultural theory background, and her clinical experience includes working with athletes, couples, chronic illness, and disordered eating. In previous decades, training and employment at university college counseling centers was considered a prestigious and well-rounded option for therapists. Yet, in the past 5 years, clinicians have been leaving in droves due to burnout, caused in part by a mixture of non-competitive pay and unsustainable work expectations. Today, we hear from Dr. Burgess about why she remains passionate about college counseling work, as well as how counselors can prepare for leadership roles in these settings. Dr. Burgess, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you, Jack. It's good to be here.
Well, how about you start us off by walking us through your journey and sharing any memorable events and circumstances that may have influenced how you got into this work?
Definitely. So I was born and raised in Singapore and came to the US for undergrad. And when I was at Georgetown University, that is where I actually tried therapy for the first time at our university's CAPS. And, you know, I think the fact that it was on campus, it was very, very cost effective because it was part of what the school was offering. Definitely reduced some of the initial barriers there to considering what therapy could mean to me. And it definitely changed the course of even what I was majoring in. I moved from pre-med to psych and sociology and loved being in DC so much that I decided that that's where I wanted to go to grad school. In the course of my time at GW, I did a placement at Catholic University's Counseling Center. And that was my first time working or doing an externship at a counseling center. And I was really just blown away by the range of experiences that a therapist could have on staff at a counseling center. So obviously you could do individual, you could do group counseling, you would be part of supervision, you know, both of your colleagues, peer supervision, as well as trainee therapists. And that's exactly what I was benefiting from as an extern. And so I had no idea that being a therapist or being a psychologist could mean so many things all at the same time. And the richness of that experience is really what kind of prompted me to pursue continuing to work in college counseling settings for both my internship as well as my postdoc.
First of all, thank you very much for sharing that. As some folks, especially amongst Asian Americans, we don't have, I guess, we're not accessing therapy as, you know, a common thing. It's right. Usually a stigma. So to be able to access that at a undergrad level,
right,
is fantastic. And to use that experience to springboard you and being curious about the profession,
right,
I think is fantastic, phenomenal. And then to make it a career.
Right.
And the way you're describing College Counseling Center, it really does provide a breadth of different skill sets that we can tap into as psychologists.
Right.
And so you went from there and you stuck with college counseling. Or actually, no, you also did K-12. So can you share with me some of the transitional periods?
Sure. So while I was at GW's PsyD program, I got some experience in community mental health, as well as working at a K-8 school as part of my pre-doctoral hours that I was accruing. And I wanted a chance to, you know, explore different sites to also get a feel for, you know, where could I imagine myself working? You know, how would I see myself as an independent clinician down the line? And I think the fact that ours is a pretty service-oriented field or career. And something about both, you know, community mental health and the school setting that really appealed to me is here is a way for folks to access therapy services in a way that is affordable and really readily accessible, right? And so almost regardless of what your family circumstances are, whether there's that stigma that you mentioned or not at home, in your place of education, in your place of work, right, you're looking around and you see people that are saying to you, therapy is not just okay, but it's honestly for everyone, right? And here are the professionals showing up for you so that you know that it's okay to go to therapy and get that additional support that you may need. And when I think about college counseling, that sentiment definitely translates as well. You know, students are at college age are oftentimes kind of individuating for the first time or learning for themselves what are the values that I really hold on to, which may overlap with the values that I learned from my family, but may also be different. And that's exactly part of what my college experience is supposed to introduce me to. And so I think if you're in that mindset, there might be some more readiness for therapy that maybe you wouldn't experience at other stages of your life because you're not open to it in the same way.
Yeah. Good point. It's like having a therapeutic support during this time of navigating transitions and exploring how maybe your family values and teachings may correspond with your new, I guess, trajectory,
right,
in life as you're pursuing college.
Right.
So in thinking about this career in college counseling, can you talk a little bit more about maybe because you've been in it for 9+ years? I mean,
yeah,
you've seen that shift. And, you know, I'm familiar just vaguely familiar about different college counseling centers. And some have, you know, they don't have as many sessions. You know, previously, yeah, it may have been, you know, 20 or so sessions, but some have really reduced it down. And so can you maybe share with me just what you've seen over the time period of your 9 years?
Yeah. I've in a variety of different roles have now worked at 4 different counseling centers, and you know, they each have their own model. They're each of different sizes, from small private colleges to large public universities. And there are some that have a very hard and fast 3 to 6 session limit. And there are some that have a more generous session limit, including where I'm working right now, that we actually don't have a session limit, but we use pretty creative ways to kind of manage that demand from students. So I think something that I've really seen is when I started in college counseling as an extern, that was really maybe the beginning of where centers were seeing that they weren't able to keep up with demand as much as they'd been able to. And I think that's part of the kind of burnout that you mentioned earlier in my introduction. Is it's really hard feeling for therapists to want to do work, want to do good and meaningful work. And if you're presented with session limits and you have to be the one that tells students, like, you know, we only get 6 sessions to work together, and then I have to refer you out, that definitely takes away from the satisfaction of the job. So I have no doubt that kind of strict impositions on counselors' work have also led to lower job satisfaction. But one thing that I think maybe the pandemic also gave a lot of centers the permission to do is be flexible with what care looks like. You know, what does a traditional model of service look like, and what can it look like, which is kind of where I am now. And certainly I think the fact that I'm in a director position maybe gives me more license to be a bit more creative. I think it is hard when you're a trainee or maybe a staff psychologist to necessarily have as much of a voice of what could our center look like. But at the same time, creativity is oftentimes driven by need. And I think many centers now are in this position where it's very, very hard to keep up with the demand that students have. And rather than just cracking down by wait lists and session limits, it might be time for different centers to think a bit more creatively and figure out wider ways to reach students. And so that's kind of what we're doing here at HOPE.
Can you share with me some of the creative ways
that Sure.
you've been able to do, I guess, either support work, outreach, or, you know, whatever is going to help the students?
Absolutely. So I would say it's kind of two-pronged in our approach. So using a more public health kind of model, where what outreach looks like these days has to be different. In previous iterations, outreach was more about, here's the counseling center, please come see us. You know, we're looking for students to come and attend our sessions, or please make sure that you are aware of these services. There's still part of that in terms of advertising, so to speak, but because there's so much need and maybe a lot more openness to mental health just as a topic or as an important part of college students' education, we're really looking to kind of deliver a dose of therapy, so to speak, or to deliver a dose of care in any one of our interactions. So we every year have something in the orientation packet for students. And in previous years, it may be a sticker or a magnet, something with some kind of brief information about our center and how to contact us. This year, we made it, in addition to our contact information, we had a 4-square breathing sticker. And part of our orientation training for all the orientation advisors was how to do 4-square breathing. So if nothing else, not only do you have our contact information, but now here are a group of students on campus that have the information, have the psychoeducation to do this kind of relaxation or meditation exercise. So they can go on and teach, whether it's the first years in their orientation groups or their friends, right? If someone is experiencing elevated anxiety, how do you work through using this 4-square breathing method, right? And so that's kind of like a dose of care that we're giving on top of just advertising for ourselves. So I think really rethinking both the big and little things is one way that we're going about it.
Being very practical too, and infusing just even at a very small dose of the therapeutic work.
Right.
Can you tell me more about what it is like for you as a person of color and working in the college counseling center environment?
Yeah.
as well as possibly maybe some of your experiences in noticing reaching out to clients of color.
Right. Yeah, most definitely. I mean, I think my identity is pretty central to whom I am and how I show up as a therapist. I think my career thus far has definitely been informed by not just my ethnic identity, you know, my identity as a woman, but my nationality as well, like being able to think about what job opportunities are available to me as a non-citizen. So while I had to navigate using my student visa, what were jobs that I was even eligible for? You know, how to think kind of critically about that. That certainly played a role. But then, you know, thinking about these intersecting identities, what kind of power, what kind of voice did I have as a trainee? You know, who were my mentors, right? I think it's not an accident that two of my biggest mentors were directors while I was an extern and then while I was also an intern. And so I think that was transformational, that people were looking at me and saying, you know, you could do this, right? Like you could actually learn how to do this work. So I certainly am grateful to them for kind of infusing that in me. Two places that I've worked at so far are predominantly white institutions. And so when I think about not just being an employee, but increasingly holding a leadership role, it's predominantly white, not just in the student demographics, but, you know, most certainly in the staff and faculty demographics as well. So when I think about what that means for me to be an outsider in so many ways, right? Physically not looking like anyone else on my staff, being not from this area or from this region, you know, I think there's a certain amount of imposter syndrome that I think, in spite of holding leadership positions, I continue to wrangle with, and legitimately not being from the same culture. Right now, you know, I'm in West Michigan, right? I did not grow up here. This is my second year only living here. And so there's a certain amount of culture and tradition that I have to learn to sort of get to know the people that I'm working with. But then all the more, I think being someone in a leadership role at a PWI, that makes my interactions with students from a variety of backgrounds all the more important, right? So what are the odds that a white student going to school in West Michigan would have had a non-white therapist? Would have been pretty slim. And so I, you know, certainly, of course, I want to think about who are my students of color that I'm able to work with and that they're able to see some semblance of representation in their therapist. But I think about it for our white students as well, right? Like here you are and here's an opportunity to work with someone from a wildly different background and realize that you can still form a close and meaningful relationship with them. So that's been really, really important. And I think something that we've talked about before is also the pressure of it, right? Like I am currently the only therapist of color on staff, but that doesn't mean that my sole job or my role is to meet with every single student of color on campus. I can't, I don't have the capacity to. And as I just mentioned, I think there's utility and there's meaning in me seeing students of all and any background. So my role, as I see it, is to ensure that, you know, anyone who's employed by this counseling center has the skill, has the competence, has the openness, and really the right attitude in working with students from a variety of backgrounds. And sort of that, I think, is my larger scale role, not in a one-to-one therapy setting, but really as an advocate, right, in terms of what is the kind of care that I want students of my current institution, what is the kind of care that I want them to expect? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so when you're describing this stance, there is a social justice lens to it.
Right.
Because we're thinking how challenging it is as a person of color to work in an environment that is predominantly white.
Right.
But you're taking a different stance saying, well, it's just not, yes, that may be true. However, just the exposure to working with a person of color, especially a student, that is beneficial for them. So it really reshapes the experience of, oh, I can still have a meaningful relationship with someone who is different than I am.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think there's a certain humility, I think, that that is important. Obviously, for all of us, you know, therapists, we know about cultural humility and how important that is as a stance for us to have with clients. But, you know, I think sometimes we can fall into a trap with representation of, you know, just having a person of color on staff, that's the goal. How well trained is that person of color? You know, how open are they to engaging with folks from different backgrounds too, right? And I can think of students I see who come from literally all over the world, right? And so I am drawing from my experiences as an immigrant, yes, as a ethnically South Asian person, yes. But at the same time, you know, I can't pretend to understand what the experience is like of someone who is here seeking refugee status, right? Or an asylee, right? And those are things that I can connect with someone because I want to, and I try to educate myself, and I remain open to meeting that client as a person. So I want to make sure that, you know, I am still approaching this in as humble of a way as possible, and not just assuming that as a person of color, I have what it takes to meet with any single other client of color and assume that I know their experience. And I think that's a trap that we can fall into sometimes as well.
To lose the curiosity.
Right.
To lose
right.
the humility. Yeah.
Right.
Tell me more about, you know, we're talking about social justice as part of your work, and we were seeing glimpses of it. Can you share with me other examples how you incorporate social justice work in college counseling centers?
Absolutely. I think of the fact that in college counseling, you know, we mentioned earlier that this may be the first opportunity for a student to even seek counseling, right? Or to understand that this is a resource that is available for them. It is a time where they likely will not have to pay for therapy or have it come out of their student fee. So it's a lot more affordable than it would be at other stages of their life. And so really wanting to make sure that this is as meaningful as possible so that they can actually take advantage of this. And I'm quite upfront, you know, in some outreach with students, I'll say, it's not very often or maybe not likely that there will be other points in your life where you will have free therapy. Just as a matter of fact. And there are real backlogs in terms of getting care, whether it's psychiatry or therapy in many places in the country. And at this moment, our center does not operate on a wait list. We don't have a wait list. There isn't a wait to come in and be seen by a counselor. And that's just an experience you're not likely to have very often, at least if our current model of mental health in the country stands. So just out of sheer curiosity, why not come in and meet with somebody and see whether this is something that's for you? So that sort of like agency, you know, letting them know this isn't mandated, this isn't something you have to do or is a punishment of any sorts, but because this is available, absolutely, please come in and try it out. So I think that's one aspect that I think is really important, that it's financially accessible to students. I think about our partnerships on campus as really important. Students will connect with different pockets of campus in a way that feels most comfortable for them. So making sure that we have a voice with the Center for Diversity and Inclusion, with disability and accessibility resources, with Res Life, right? With athletics, with Greek Life, right? Frats and sororities, with campus ministries, right? And these are all offices where different students will kind of connect to more closely. And I also need to make sure that all of those offices have a good working relationship with us so that if they have a student that connects with them, they can kind of vouch for us and say, oh yeah, you know, I know so-and-so in that office. Let me walk you over and we'll see if we can make you an appointment. I don't need to be everyone's go-to, but I need to have the relationships with other folks on campus so that they can point students in our direction.
Yeah. Ooh, I love that. It's you're building relationships with these pockets of organizations that actually serve more closely to the students' day-to-day lives.
Right.
I can't help just drawing from my own experience in working with at integrated care settings.
Right.
In primary care, behavioral health, you have to develop these relationships with different teams.
Right.
You know, and knowing that, oh, I'm the face, or this is the program.
Right.
That you can just literally walk your clients or patients to my office and we can have a chat.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think there are some times where, you know, so yeah, you're absolutely using this sort of like community approach, right? What does care look like in a truly holistic way, right? So as you are getting your, let's say, your spiritual needs met by someone at Campus Ministries, and they're able to identify, you know, I'm really glad you're coming to us and talking about this, but I think it's also beneficial for you to see someone at the health center or someone at CAPS, right? Like we're taking this real team approach to making sure that different dimensions of a student's well-being are really attended to. And that I think is a pretty social justice driven approach as well, right? Some of the most meaningful moments that I can think of are also when students who may not have a ton of support from their family of origin to seek therapy have come in and they've built really great relationships with us. And they kind of have to make a decision about how do I bring my family into my care, right? How do I bridge that gap? Maybe I'm going home for the summer and I need continuation of care, or I'm graduating and, you know, it's going to show up on my insurance or my parents' insurance if I continue in therapy. And there comes a point where they maybe need us to be that bridge to facilitate a conversation with their parents. That is risky. You certainly run the risk of parents not being supportive, or maybe not being happy that you're treating their student and this has been, or their child, and this has been a secret from them. But then you get to have these conversations where now the family dynamic is able to change and the parents are getting a version of psychoeducation that they didn't have either access to or that they weren't familiar with or open to. And it almost, it's not quite family therapy, but you're at least starting that conversation with them and they get to see whatever other assumptions I had about therapy. I'm looking directly at a therapist right now. I'm seeing the connection that they have with my child and it's meaningful. So if nothing else, now I know at least one therapist that has been helpful to my family. And I really think that you can't underestimate how that like small seed really takes root in the family going forward. So that's meaningful to me too.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. It never occurred to me just, you know, the idea of continued care after leaving college or, you know, leaving for the semester and then involving family in the picture and having those conversations. So now earlier you talked a little bit about the imposter syndrome that you faced. Okay. So more poignantly, as a person of color, what were some challenges that you faced and overcame that you would be willing to share?
Sure. I mentioned that for this role that I'm in now, which is a director role, and I moved from Washington, D.C. to West Michigan. So the demographics of those regions are wildly different. You know, D.C. really being a true blend of all kinds of cultures. And West Michigan, although it definitely has its pockets, it's sort of known for being a more homogeneously white and Christian region. And I think at this stage, being director, wanting to come in and have a certain sense of confidence or calm about what I'm bringing to this institution while genuinely learning on the go, right? Like not only the day-to-day, what does this job entail? What does it mean to be a director? But also I'm living in a brand new environment. So there are so many things that I have to stay curious about, right? What is it that I have to maybe admit or acknowledge? Yeah, I really don't have any information about this because I'm brand new to this area as well. That actually gave me a lot of credibility with first years or freshmen last year, because when they didn't know something, I could easily say to them, yeah, me either. Like I'm brand new to the area. But yeah, you know, I think there were intersecting factors of being relatively young and stepping into a leadership role, being a woman and a person of color in a institution that is largely white. And I've built some really wonderful relationships with folks. And there are certainly times where you can't help but wonder, like, okay, you know, would you have made this comment, or would you have asked this question if I were a man, or if I were older, right? Or if I were white? And not really having the answer, I think just having that lingering question of, I'm not sure if this is why we're interacting this way, can be hard, especially when I'm feeling the internal pressure to portray myself a certain way, right? I'm the director, I need to know what's going on. And so those can be really hard and really vulnerable to hold at the same time. And so I think for myself, being able to still talk to some of my mentors, you know, some of whom are people of color, some of the supervisors that I've had, have my own therapy, make sure that I still have someone that I can talk to and really work through my feelings with. Those have been crucial, I think, to me being able to decipher what of this is the voice of imposter syndrome versus this is something that I legitimately need to think about and maybe find an answer for. And so, yeah, that continues to be, I think, a work in progress of how I manage that.
Wow. This is an active process you're describing.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you're really building a team of folks, colleagues, support network to help you sustain this type of work.
Right.
And so in thinking about that, it sounds like, you know, this makes sense, which is, it sounds like a recommendation, which I'll ask.
Yeah.
What is one recommendation you would give to therapists of color who are considering a career in college counseling?
Right.
Particularly for those who are considering leadership roles.
Most certainly is to find mentors. And I would say to let them know that you consider them mentors as well. So through grad school, you know, we have a variety of supervisors, some that we maybe fit with better or really like stick in our memory greater than others. I realized that having mentors who were clinicians of color, that was important, I think, to be able to see, honestly, model for me, right? How do you show up in these spaces? And they came from a variety of ethnic, gender, sexual orientation backgrounds. And so I can sort of see how people use their intersecting identities and show up in these leadership spaces. And that was important for me when I was a trainee to watch and see. But then as the years go by, you know, I got licensed, I got a staff psychologist position to really still keep in touch with those supervisors that I identified as mentors. And sometimes it may be things that I want to talk about in a personal way. I have supervisors that are now more like friends, I think, the further away we've gotten from my training experience. But I kind of had to ask pretty openly some of my mentors, look, I think I want to develop my leadership skills. So I love college counseling. I want to do this work. I'm not sure whether that means I will be a training director or a clinical director, but I want to make a difference in this field. What do I need to do? And so being quite direct, actually, which can be a risk, right? I think if people see you as, you know, there are certain labels like ambitious, which kind of have a double-edged tone to it, right? Whether or not a woman or a woman of color is ambitious can be taken multiple ways, or that I was young, you know, and so like, do I think getting too big for my britches and trying to climb a ladder? All of these are things that can be perceived very differently depending on who is doing the climbing, right? And so finding someone who would be honest with me, one of my most recent boss and one of my greatest mentors has been a director for decades, and he's been really honest with me about how much the field has changed. And I think the pandemic was certainly a time where we saw directors leaving the job in droves. Literally hundreds of directors either retired early or went into private practice. because in a lot of ways, the stress that the job demanded wasn't necessarily worth the satisfaction that they were getting. It became an entirely different job. And that was both terrifying to hear from someone that you respect so greatly and you see as this like very stable model of a director. Terrifying, but necessary. You know, I think otherwise I would have walked into this without my eyes open, with a naive perception of what this job looked like. But to hear that from him, I could still make an informed decision of this might be really difficult and maybe this is a short-term season of my life. But let me be honest about it and still walk into this knowing that because college counseling has been, I mean, it's really shaped who I am professionally, but it was so important for me personally, right? Like this was my first chance at being a client of a therapist, right? So this was so important to me. If college counseling is turning into something that's so much less sustainable and so much less appealing, am I just going to give up on it? Or do I want to see if I can have a role in keeping it going, right? Even if it's just for a few years, let me do it.
Yeah, or change it for the better.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And that's exactly what I'm working on currently. Like you said, a work in progress.
Oh, very admirable to be able to be in an environment that, you know, has been very challenging, particularly through the pandemic.
Yeah.
And I would suspect that the type of situations that students are also coming in to seek treatment for, it's also changed over time.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, do you have any just anecdotal information in terms of what you've seen are presenting issues that people are coming in with just over the course of the 9 years?
Sure. I think right out of the pandemic, two of the greatest changes in presenting concerns, and this is using data from CCMH, which is the Center for Collegiate Mental Health that is out of Penn State. They collect national data, and disordered eating and body image concerns was in, like right off the bat, one of the greatest jumps in frequency. Social anxiety, I think, is another one that has really increased. And I think that is also due to some of our students coming into college now just don't have those skills, right? Everything was online for a number of years. They didn't have to be in person. Skills like using the phone to make a call, right? These aren't skills that they've had to use. And so it's not even so much they don't want to as much as they haven't needed to, or they haven't learned that this is an important skill. So I definitely think of social anxiety as another presenting concern that's really increased. But also, you know, I think with this conversation about mental health, it's great that a lot of people are talking about it more than in pre-pandemic. But, you know, I think that also allows for things like trauma and family dysfunction to be talked about more, especially after, you know, maybe folks had to stay home and or go back from college to environments that weren't necessarily the best place for them. I think that was another reason that there's been an increase in students seeking care for trauma, is that it's okay. You know, there's more permission almost to talk about these things post-pandemic. I think a flip side, it's positive and negative, is there are more resources for students that are dealing with and maybe have dealt with more severe mental illness through the years. So in a good way, there are more students meeting those criteria that are entering college and are actually sticking through with college than there have been in previous decades, which is a great thing because that means college is more accessible. But then the kind of care that we offer on campus also has to shift, because if it's more severity, right, or more chronic conditions for us to work with, than just the resources you had for working through adjustment difficulties or breakups, like that's not what college counseling work is anymore. So I think you require the support of an institution that will change with you as you're providing that kind of the data on this is what we're seeing and this is what we need in order to properly serve these students, institutions have to be able to respond to that as well and support you.
There's definitely a skill piece that is going to be required now for psychologists entering college counseling centers.
Right.
It's also going back to the importance of the holistic approach building in the medical model, because you have to develop relationships with your medical team to address some of these chronic health conditions, to be more involved in the care. It isn't just, I'm coming to this college counseling center for mental health treatment or this building, but there needs to be more integrated.
Right.
You've really brought in a lot of insight, a lot of perspective. And we haven't had a lot of conversations this season about college counseling centers. So how can people reach you if they have any questions?
Absolutely. So you can feel free to send me an email. My email is my last name, virgus@hope.edu. I'm more than happy to answer questions that way. You can follow the Hope Caps on Instagram as well to see what our center is up to. But yeah, I'm more than happy to answer any questions that people have who are interested in pursuing or maybe rejoining the college counseling world, you know, as it continues to shift.
Lastly, how do we support you?
Thank you. I appreciate that question. Keeping me in prayer as I continue to learn my role, but also just checking in on any colleagues that you have who are in college counseling centers, knowing that they're doing hard work, and thanking them for sticking with the college counseling work. Because I think it's easy to find maybe more lucrative opportunities elsewhere. And, you know, I'm not going to begrudge anyone wanting to get paid what they deserve. And college counseling can really be both of those things. So just encouraging your fellow colleagues you know who are in the college counseling world.
Dr. Virgus, thank you very much for your insight and sharing your experiences with us. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Jack.
A huge thank you to our listeners. If you like what you've heard, please share and subscribe to our podcast, People of Color in Psychology. Other ways to support us include registering for continuing education courses or making a donation on the Multicultural Counseling Institute's website. We value your input and appreciate your continued support. You can send us an email, a message on LinkedIn, or send us a voice message on our website. Until next time, this is your host, Jack Zunn.